Now we're going to change gears on what we're doing. And right now, for the first time, formally introduce Eckhart and Charlie Albright. Eckhart, meet Charlie. Charlie, meet Eckhart.
Hello.
Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
Charlie Albright, who's the pianist for the Beethoven Third Concerto on this concert this weekend. And in a way, that kind of is how it is, isn't it? That you've hired somebody that you've never met and you know they're going to play, and all of a sudden you meet each other and then figure out how you're going to make music together, right?
You go by a reputation, yeah. You know? I mean, you. I saw Charlie's name, I think it was, with the Cincinnati Chamber Orchestra or somewhere. I can't remember where. And then I asked, you know, and they said, he was phenomenal. I said, okay, I'll believe you. You know, I mean, if you have people whom you trust,
right.
Because, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of pianists out there, and you have to kind of pick your own favorites after a while. And so when there's a new person in the circuit coming up, you try to get them fairly early on so that you're already friends and you have a relationship when they tend to grow out of your budget. So.
Okay. Well, welcome, Charlie, while you're still within our budget.
Thank you.
And so... then I know that the reality here is that what happens in understanding music is when you start making music together. But what kind of goes through your minds when the conductor and the soloist know that you're about to play Beethoven together? And what's going on? Do you either of you have preconceptions you warn each other about? What about you, Charlie, when you're going into the situation like this?
Well, I mean, Beethoven is one of those composers that, especially in a piece like the Beethoven Third Concerto, it's one of those you really can't play right until you're about 87 or so because of the maturity that's and the depth of what he writes in between all of the notes. So, you know, on the surface, you have a lot of scales and arpeggios and things like that that make it a very Beethoven sound. But underneath, it's what's not explicitly written that is really kind of hard to capture. He has so much restraint in his writing. And especially in the third, there's this sense of majesty and passion that it is throughout that, you know, it takes a lifetime to master, I think. But you do your best. So come back in a few decades and we'll maybe try it again.
Is this your first performance of this piece, or have you played it?
No, I've played it many times before.
So you're a veteran within your age group.
Maybe.
Beethoven Third. And kind of how do you respond to those ideas, Matej, that Charlie's saying about Beethoven?
Well, I mean, this concerto is a little bit, for me, an orphan among the five. You know, the second and the third are the ones that are the least played. And when I looked at it again after many years, I think last time we did it with Conrad Tau, and that's probably five years ago. I think I know why, because it is a piece in between. It's part of an evolutionary process to the final kind of Beethoven sound, the more muscular, bigger sound that everybody expects. You know, it's like with the symphony. So the first one, you know, is kind of more Mozartian, and the same thing is with the piano concerto. And the third is right in the middle. There's a little bit Mozart always looking there, and then all of a sudden he goes crazy, and it's very very Beethoven. Then he goes very adventurous stuff. I mean, like almost like poetry, and he just wanders off like a composed fantasy, and so it's in German we say it's neither fish nor meat. It's like something in between, you know. And I think for people it is more difficult. Also, maybe for pianists or conductors, it's more difficult to really align with what is this. It's not clean cut, but that I think is exactly what the charm is about the piece.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Any further thoughts about, you know, about that sense of the ambiguity of the ambiguity of its style?
Well, I think he knocked it right on the head. It's kind of that transition period between what we consider classical mm-hmm. music and kind of a more romantic mm-hmm. sound, and it's, you know, he kind of straddles both one foot on over each side of the line, and that can make it very difficult.
And it's particularly in the second movement. I think the second movement is one of the most beautiful things you'll ever hear. But there, I think he really goes into the romantic side.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, the first movement, it feels very Mozartian, actually,
yeah.
Particularly in the beginning. But then in the second movement, he throws everything out of the window and starts with it's like, voila, there's a whole new style. But it's so beautiful. But there's no way you can play it like Mozart. It's just impossible.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right.
Well, I think that's a good intro for the listener and what they're going to experience in the Beethoven Third Piano Concerto. So, moving toward focusing on you, Charlie, can you, coming out of all these words, and think of something you'd go to the piano and play for us right now?
I'm debating between maybe playing something by Kapustin or doing a short improvisation. What would you prefer?
I think you should do the improvisation now and maybe do the Kapustin at the end.
Sure,
if we get to it. Okay, do you want to say anything about the improvisation or just go start improvising? We'll figure out where you started and what you did it on.
I'll go start something.
Okay,
I have no clue what I'm going to play.
Okay, I'll point to you when we're ready.
All right.
So Charlie Albright, going to the piano in the studio. He had a fine time warming up and playing a few of his things. And he will talk about this when he comes back in, is his amazing duality of being able to really live in both of these worlds. So here we are. Charlie is at the piano in the studio, and this is his improvisation he's going to give us. Live in our studio, an improvisation that was just done by our guest Charlie Albright, who is playing Beethoven with the symphony, but as we hear, has quite a repertoire. It's a repertoire which is called simply music. So make yourself comfortable, Charlie, whichever microphone you want to be at. Thank you. Wow, that was fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. And what I want to ask about in these silly ways of using words where we shouldn't use words, but is the sense of style. The world is full of musical style that we put names to Baroque, to periods, to jazz, to classical, if we were to say that this sounded a little like Chopin or something like that. Mm-hmm. When you sit down to improvise, do you get into a certain head of a certain style that you want to do, or where? How did you choose that particular
sure.
language that you just used?
Well, I'm personally a big fan of the kind of late classical romantic style mm-hmm. of music within what we call mm-hmm. classical music. Mm-hmm. So I just like the way romantic music generally sounds. And so I find myself kind of leaning in that direction whenever I compose or improvise, just because of I think it sounds good.
Oh, that's a good reason. Yeah. And so you have no choice at this point in your career but to tell your whole life story, which so far isn't too long to tell, maybe. But certainly of your background, of you as a kid, were you the dutiful kid who played your hand in exercises, or did you space out and play whatever you wanted and drive the piano teacher crazy? Which kid were you?
A little bit of both, but probably more the latter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I started piano when I was about 3 and a half. We had an old, clunky, junky upright in our house. My mom played enough that we had that kind of a garage sale piano in the house. And I guess I climbed up and started pecking out Twinkle Little Star by ear. So my mom asked, who taught me that? And I guess I said, nobody did, I heard it, or something like that. So she saw I had a knack for music, and she started me with a few neighborhood music teachers and piano store teachers and stuff. And I was playing entirely by ear for several years. And I'd play everything from the Backstreet Boys to Great Balls of Fire and everything other than Beethoven and Chopin and all that. And I couldn't read a note of music. And I was taking from a jazz teacher at the time when he recommended, when I was about 7 or so, that I have a year's worth of classical training to develop my technique.
Okay, there you go.
So
we've heard that story before.
Yeah, so the idea was that I would go do classical music and then come back to the fun stuff, right? And so I started with Nancy Adsit in Olympia, Washington. I grew up in Centralia, Washington. And I started classical music, and it just kind of went from there. And then so I was doing more and more performing and competing, and in high school I started performing around the country, so I was away a lot, and I had to kind of decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to do music or do one of my other interests? I was very interested in medicine and in business, and I thought, what do I need to do? And, I don't come from a wealthy family by any means, so I knew that whatever I did, I had to be able to support myself. I love piano, but, I don't want to live under a bridge either. So, what do I do? And so I thought, what if I can do both? And there were a lot of joint programs that were kind of starting up at around that time between an academic school and a music school. So most of them, or many of them, are bachelor master's programs. So you can go to the academic school, get a bachelor's degree in whatever you want, completely unrelated it can be. And you can also get your master's in music at the same time. Instead of taking 4 plus 2 years, it's only 5 years total. And you graduate the same speed as everyone else from the academic school. So I applied, and so I ended up going to Harvard and New England Conservatory. Mm-hmm. And my undergrad, I did economics with pre-medicine. But I was doing music at the same time for my master's. And so I went there and was performing more and more throughout. Many, many times I remember emailing in problem sets from hotels when I was touring on the weekends. And at the end, I had to kind of make a decision. I had interned on Wall Street, and I realized that these other things were interests, but music was a passion, and there's a world of difference between something that you're passionate about and something that you're just kind of interested in. So I decided to go full tilt on the music and did my AD at Juilliard, and now I'm just touring.
Okay. Wow. That's a very concise but thorough way to tell the story. So that means if you're flying somewhere far away for a gig and they need a doctor on the plane, you might be able to do first aid.
No, I don't think so. But
wow, what an amazing story! And when you were doing all that intense stuff, that must have been really a lot of hard work to be doing all those three interests at the same time. Are you somebody who only sleeps 3 hours a night or something?
No. If I sleep any less than 8 hours, I feel it all day. But it was definitely kind of a juggle, you know. So sometimes when I had big conches coming up, you'd do your little less work on the school, and then other times you'd focus more on the schoolwork. Mm-hmm. It was a juggle, but I got through it.
And so your piano teachers, especially, by the time you got to college,
yes,
did they get it? Did they understand who you were and what your strengths were so that they could work with that?
Absolutely. So I was with Nancy Yatz until I started college. Mm-hmm. And then through Harvard NEC, I was with Hwang Young-byun at New England Conservatory. And she is an amazing person. All three of my primary teachers are amazing people. And then at Juilliard, I was with Veda Kaplinsky. Mm-hmm. And they all understood where I was coming from and what I was doing. And they were extremely supportive.
Yeah. And so then you've decided to go with the passion. Have you done the traditional route, the competitions and all that?
Oh, I've done a lot of competitions when I was younger, but primarily beginning in college, I was giving enough concerts and touring enough that I could I was fortunate enough to be able to focus entirely on performing. Yeah.
And then through all of this, you are said to play jazz. Do you truly play jazz? I mean, are you invested in the jazz world? And
I play a lot of jazz for fun. I wouldn't say that I'm amazing at it or anything by any means, but I love to play it. Everything from, boogie woogie to more serious jazz.
But you haven't put yourself through school by doing any late night jazz clubs or anything?
No,
like
late
that?
Night jazz clubs.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. What about any jazz ensemble stuff or anything like that?
Not too much. It's something that I think would be a lot of fun, but I haven't had that chance yet.
Mm-hmm. And so then, within all this, as you define your interests, where does new music come in, and both composed music and then improvised music, and then your own composition?
Sure. Well, I do a whole ton. In my solo recital series, I usually do a lot of traditional music, but I also have carve out time for improvisations where I often get notes from the audience. So I'll have like four people give four random notes and use that as a basis. Sometimes I'll give an entirely improvised concert, so an hour and a half, 2 hours, where you can really delve into something like creating an entire sonata or a set of works. I do new music as well. This coming January, I'm doing my main stage debut at Carnegie with the American Symphony. Mm-hmm. And we're doing the New York debut of a piece by Vivian Fine, the concertante mm-hmm. for piano and orchestra. So I'm really looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. It's not brand new, but it's never been played there. A little bit of a lot.
And then, again, one of these kind of unanswerable questions. But when you sit down to improvise a large work, not just a little mm-hmm. two-minute improvisation, but you spoke of an improvised sonata, kind of, do you sit there for 20 seconds and try to map it out in your head and try to figure out some points you're going to reach, or do you simply let the first note lead to the second note and see where you end up?
It's kind of a combination of that. So when I improvise, I really want it to be a composition. Like, I want it to have a beginning, a middle, an end, a point, and ideally, you want it to be cohesive, right? And sometimes when you're improvising, you run the risk of just kind of rambling on for mm-hmm. 5 or 10 or 20 or however many minutes. So a lot of times when I'm performing, a big kind of the overarching kind of structural thing in your head is, in terms of structure, is the time that you have. So do I have 30 minutes to make a piece, or is this going to be a 2.5 minute long thing? And then that kind of gives you a framework within to build. And aside from that, I don't really think. It's more of, I wanted to have a beginning, middle, and end, but the emotion kind of guides the piece. So it's almost like having a big box of Legos where you have thousands of different colors and shapes and sizes, and you can put those together in any way to build basically whatever you want. But you still have the underlying, rudimentary framework to work with.
Yeah. Charlie Albright, who's the soloist playing Beethoven with the Spokane Symphony. And I want to go slip sideways here for a moment, because there's several things about you that seems like you're the pianist for right now, for 2018. Number one, you're not Charles, you're Charlie.
Yeah.
So you didn't feel that you had to take on some serious classical moniker or anything like
Absolutely.
that. Absolutely. Yeah. And then also, you were just telling me how you felt you didn't have to sentence yourself to living in New York all your life.
Yeah, well, I lived in New York full time for about 5 years, and I was in Boston 5 years before that, and wonderful cities, and I love being there. But living there full time, I realized, you know, I didn't really need to physically be here. So as a pianist, one of the unique things about being a pianist is that you're often not part of an orchestra. You're a soloist, and it's about as solo an instrument as they come, you know. And so I was living in New York, going to JFK Airport every single weekend and thinking to myself, well, if I have an airport, I can really be anywhere as long as I have a major airport. And so, you know, my wife and I decided to move to Seattle. And I'm part-time between both New York and Seattle, but it's nice to have a more traditional kind of, you know, home with a real piano that you can have and actually practice on. So it's great.
And then I'm gathering that at this part of your life, you don't really focus on any primary teaching because you simply need to have a freer schedule than that, don't you?
Correct. I do maintain a tiny studio, you know, 1 to 2 students, and it kind of just varies depending. But I only teach via FaceTime. So that way I can, regardless of where in the world I am, I find a time with the piano, a time with my student, and we just have a lesson via the internet, so that seems to work.
So once again, you're truly a person of now. So as long as we're defining you and profiling you as a person of now, talk about how you feel about the musical world right now. Is it are you endangered? Are you worried about having a lifetime career in this world with everybody going to their flat things and not showing up to concerts, or is it working just fine?
I think that classical music, I did an article for CNN a couple years ago we titled it Classical, in quotes, Music is Dying, and that's the best thing for classical music, and the second classical not being in quotes. And the point of my article was basically that the classical rules, the old-fashioned rules that kind of developed for really no reason, they just kind of just formed in the past 100, 200 years, didn't usually exist when a lot of this music was actually composed. And they've kind of developed, and I think that a lot of that prevents people from really being, prevents the music from really being accessible. And I think that, you know, things like doing improvisations, which used to be done all the time, but now is very rarely done, talking to the audiences, you know, making music fun and interesting and really accessible to all is, you know, is a great way to bring people in, because sometimes I've had the chance of giving concerts in, you know, big cities and small towns as well. And a lot of times, even the little kids who've never really experienced classical music maybe themselves are genuinely interested in it. But I think we have to make sure that we keep it open and accessible to people and not kind of, you know, put up walls that make it, you know, too hoity-toity, if you will.
Yeah. Charlie Albright, the musician for now, I just named you. Can you get the Capucine in 3 minutes?
I'm afraid that it's a bit short for that. But let's see. I could do a short Volodos transcription.
Oh, that would be fun.
That
yeah.
might be a little over three, but we'll see. Okay. See how fast I can play it.
That would be great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Charlie Albright, going back to the studio to play on the piano, Volodos transcription out of his absolutely forever repertoire of what he has available. So let's go back to the studio and hear that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. That impromptu performance, a Bolaños transcription done by Charlie Albright, the pianist who's playing with the symphony, playing Beethoven with the symphony on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And that brings to a close our time with Symphony Week and the many things going on by the Spokane Symphony. My thanks to everybody involved.